This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Well, September. You don't have to wait up quite so late for it to get dark. As you do throughout September, what you see in the sky after dark stays much the same, because as the constellations move around the sky by about 4 minutes every day, which would tend to make you see other constellations at a given time, darkness happens a little bit earlier, and the two tend to cancel out. So looking south after dark, we see that lovely region of sky with Cygnus the Swan, Lyra the Lyre, and Aquila the Eagle, with their bright stars Deneb, Altair, and Vega. Vega is the upper right one. If you look at that with binoculars and just move a little bit to the left, you should see a double star. It's called Epsilon Lyrae. Even without binoculars, if your eyesight is good, you might just pick it up visually. If, however, you then use a small telescope under good seeing conditions when the sky isn't too turbulent, you'll spot that each of those two stars is itself a double. So it's called the double-double. The two pairs of stars, one orbits about every 1,200 years, the other every 600 years, and the two pairs, in fact, orbit each other about once every million years or so. So that's quite a nice thing to have a look at. If you come down from Vega towards Altair, it's a dark, transparent night, you'll see there's a bit of a rift across the Milky Way because you're crossing over the Milky Way. It's called the Cygnus Rift. It's a region of dust which obscures much of the light from the stars beyond. But in that rift, you should pick up what's called Brocky's Cluster or the Coat Hanger, a little group of stars. It looks like an upside-down coat hanger. Now, the reason I mention it this month is that at the very beginning of the month, 2nd and 3rd of September, a comet, Comet Garrad, G-A-R-R-A-D-D, is actually very close to the cluster. Now, of course, you may well listen to this after the 2nd and 3rd of September, but over the next week or so, it's gradually moving westwards. That's to the right. So if you start with your binoculars on the cluster and just move gently rightwards, there's a good chance you'll pick it up. It's moving towards Hercules. Coming over to the left of Cygnus, we come to the very nice constellation of Pegasus, the winged horse, which we see upside down from the northern hemisphere. The four bright stars that make up the square of Pegasus give you actually a nice way of telling how transparent the sky is. You simply count the number of stars you can see within it. If you can see four, perhaps five, you're seeing down to about 4.5 magnitude. If you can see a lot more, your eyesight's very good and it's very transparent. Take some binoculars and start with the top rightmost of those stars. If you then move down, looking at the stars just to the right of the line going from the top to the bottom on the right, the brightest star you'll pick up is called 51 Pegasi. It's fifth magnitude. It's a star like our sun. And it was where, in about 1995, Michel Mayer and his student discovered the first planet orbiting a sun-like star. To everyone's amazement, it was about half the mass of Jupiter, so a giant planet. But it was orbiting its star every 4.2 days. That implies, of course, it's very, very close and hence very hot, about 1,200 degrees. We call these things hot Jupiters. Now, there's no way a planet like that can form so close to its sun. It must have formed way out somewhere where Jupiter is in our own solar system, but then worked its way in. And the vast majority of planets that have been discovered so far tend to be quite large and close to their sun. That's because they're easiest to detect. What we really want to know is how often we actually have planets that are the same sort of size as our Earth, orbiting in about a year, so they have the right sort of temperature to allow life to arise. Now, there's a satellite called Kepler observing the stars between Cygnus and Lyra. It's already found quite a large number of Earth-sized planets, but having only published data from 127 days of observations, they've all got to be relatively close to their star. But over the next 9 months or so, it's already got the data for more than a year, When it's observed for 1 year, it can start picking out planets orbiting with 1 year orbit. After 2 years, it will have got them all. So we will soon know how often planets like our Earth, at about the right distance from their star, so the temperature could support life, how common they are in our galaxy. And that's going to be very, very interesting. If you go to the top left star of Pegasus, it's shared with Andromeda. You move leftwards and up a little bit, one star, and then a second, a bit more to the right. Then you turn sharp right, move through one star, the same distance again. You should pick up the great nebula in Andromeda, M31, the nearest giant galaxy to us. Now, at the turn of the last century, there was a lot of debate as to whether objects, they were then called white nebulae, were actually part of our own Milky Way galaxy or lay beyond. It was Edwin Hubble in 1926 who was observing variable stars in the Andromeda galaxy, as we now call it. He found a star which was varying with a period of just over 30 days. They're called Cepheid variables. And some years earlier, Henrietta Leavitt had studied these in the Magellanic Clouds and shown that one of these stars with a period of about 30 days would have a brightness about 10,000 times that of our Sun. So estimating its brightness from its period, it's called the period-luminosity relationship, he was able to work out that Andromeda lay about 850,000 light years from the Earth. At that time, they thought the galaxy was about 300,000 light years across, so it was well outside the galaxy. Now, you'll obviously realize that both of those numbers are too small. In fact, there were two types of Cepheid variables, and the ones that Hubble had observed were, in fact, somewhat brighter, perhaps a factor of four, than those that Henrietta Leavitt had been observing, and that doubles the distance. And there were other factors, too. So now we know that Andromeda is about 2.5 million light years away. It's a lovely thing to see with a pair of binoculars. You really do want to have a night when there's no moon and the sky is nice and transparent. Well, we've talked about the stars and some of the things we can see. What about the planets? Well, we're coming to a Jupiter season. It's now rising soon after 9 p.m. and by midnight it's about 30 degrees above the eastern horizon, so not too bad to see. It's shining at magnitude -2.7, pretty bright, and it's in the constellation of Aries the Ram. The angular size is about 47 arc seconds, which means that when it's reasonably high in the sky, a small telescope will show lots of detail. And I'll come back to that in one of the highlights. Well, we've been observing Saturn for quite a few months. In principle, it is just visible during the first week or so of the month, just a few degrees above the horizon, about half an hour or so after sunset. But it'd be jolly hard to spot and probably not really worth the effort. We're going to have to wait for a while till it comes round the other side of the sun and we can see it in the pre-dawn sky. Well, Mercury, that passed between the Earth and the Sun, it's called inferior conjunction, on the 16th of August, and emerged into the pre-dawn sky at the very end of August. On the 1st of September, it's just 4 degrees above the eastern horizon an hour before dawn and reaches its peak brightness at about magnitude -0.3. As we'll see in one of the highlights, it lies very close to Regulus in Leo on the 8th and 9th of the month. But it then rapidly moves towards the sun and is lost in its glare. It passes behind the Sun, that superior conjunction, on the 28th of the month. What about Mars? On the 1st of September, Mars, shining at magnitude +1.4, lies in Gemini, just 1 degree north of the star Delta Geminorum. It's risen to an elevation of about 30 degrees by sunrise, so you can see it in the pre-dawn sky just north of east. It's rising at about 4 a.m. and will have an elevation of 40 degrees at dawn later in the month. It's not very big yet, under 5 arc seconds across, so you're unlikely to see any detail on the surface. But it's nice to see its rather lovely salmon pink colour. Well, lastly, Venus. Venus passed behind the Sun on the 15th of August. That's superior conjunction again. It actually reappears to view just above the horizon 25 minutes after sunset at the very end of the month. Even with a magnitude of about minus 3.9, you may well need binoculars to spot it. But of course, don't use them until after the sun has set. But over the next month or so, it'll become a prominent object in our evening sky. Well, finally, one or two highlights. I mentioned Jupiter. Well, a nice feature on Jupiter is the red spot. And in the highlights on the Night Sky page of the Jodrell Bank website, just put Night Sky into Google, I've listed some of the times when the red spot is actually facing us. For example, 11:35 p.m. on the 9th, 10:40 p.m. on the 14th, and so on. So have a look there, and it gives you a chance to know when you should see the red spot nicely visible facing you on the surface of Jupiter. We mentioned Mars, which has been in Gemini, but it's moving across into Cancer, and at the very end of the month, on the 30th of September, is just 0.5 degrees west, that's to the right, of the rather lovely beehive cluster, Praesepe, in Cancer. That'll be a very nice thing to observe or even photograph. As I said, Mercury, on September the 8th, is just 1.3 degrees above Regulus in Leo. Actually, it's 8 times brighter than Regulus, so that might be a nice little pairing to look at in the pre-dawn sky. You may have noticed in the news that there's a spacecraft called Dawn, which is orbiting the asteroid Vesta. At the moment, it's at its closest to the Earth, and it's 1 degree southwest, roughly, from the fourth magnitude star, Psi Capricorni. Its magnitude will be fading during the month from about 6.2 to 6.9, but if you find Psi Capricorni, then it is the nearest bright object to it, and basically it just moves during the month a little bit down to the right and then back up again. So it's quite a nice thing and an easy time to actually spot it. I'd like to mention Uranus. It reaches opposition. That's when it's due south around midnight on the 25th of September at a magnitude of 5.8. So you might just be able to see it with your unaided eye. It's in Pisces, and it's below the left-hand side of the square of Pegasus, basically about 15 degrees below. I have put a little chart on the website to show you how to find it. It's a nice little blue-green colour, and I rather like seeing it. The disk is only 3.7 arcseconds across, so don't expect to see any details. In fact, there virtually aren't any to see anyway, but it's a nice thing to spot. And finally, let's just mention Neptune. Again, you may have read that on July the 11th, Neptune completed one orbit from the night in 1846 when it was discovered. Now, you might think that was the day you would see it in exactly the same place. Well, that's actually not true, because as the Earth orbits the Sun, we see it from different directions. And in fact, Neptune will be passing through that spot in total, or will have passed, some of them, about 6 times. There are 2 still to go when you can actually see Neptune at the precise location where it was first discovered. One of those is on October the 27th, and one on November the 22nd. Again, I put a little chart to show you how to find it, but essentially you have to find the star Delta Capricornis. A little bit to its west is Gamma Capricornis, and they are both about third to fourth magnitude. If you work from Gamma through Delta and go another 5 degrees, you come to a star called I Aquarii, and Neptune is just up to the right of that. But again, look at the star chart to find it. You don't see an awful lot. The magnitude is 7.8, so you'll need binoculars or a small telescope. You might just note it's got a disk. It's 2.5 arcseconds across, and it's a blue-grey colour. But rather nice to think about Neptune having completed one orbit around the Sun.
thanks for that, Ian. And here's John Field from the Carter Observatory to tell you what's in the Southern Night Sky this month.
Kia ora and welcome to another September broadcasting from Carter Observatory, Wellington, New Zealand. September marks the time of the Southern Spring Equinox, which will be on the 23rd. This is when our daylight and nighttime hours are roughly the same. Scorpius and Sagittarius are starting a slow slide towards our western horizon, and by midnight they will be setting as Orion rises opposite in the east. Following behind Sagittarius are the fainter constellations of Capricornus, Aquarius and Pisces. Many of the constellations in this region have a watery theme, and this has been associated with the time of the Northern Hemisphere's autumn and winter rains. Capricorn means the goat horn, and this celestial creature is usually depicted as having the front of a goat and the tail of a fish. Making life more challenging for observers is the fact that this is the second faintest zodiac constellation following Cancer. In the night sky, it appears as an elongated triangle resembling a pennant with the tip facing away from Sagittarius. Above the front of the goat is a smaller, triangular grouping of stars that marks the goat's head and horns. About 2,500 years ago, the Sun moved in front of the stars of Capricorn at the time of the northern winter solstice. At the latitude of 23.5 degrees south, the Sun is overhead at noon on the day of the summer solstice, and at the sub-solar position marks the Tropic of Capricorn on the Earth's surface. Due to the precessional motion, the Sun has now moved into the constellation Sagittarius at the time of the southern summer solstice. Alpha Capricorni is a pretty but unrelated visual double star at magnitudes 3.6 and 4.2, which can be split with the unaided eye and is easily done in binoculars. The Arabic name for the star is Al-Jidi, meaning the kid or billy goat. Beta Capricornus is another pretty double, with a yellow star at magnitude 3.1 and a wide blue companion at Mag 6 that are visible in binoculars or small telescopes. Both stars are actually multiple star systems. Delta Capricornus, the tail, is actually the brightest star in the constellation at magnitude 2.9 and is approximately 40 light years away from us and consists of four stars. Following Capricornus is the large rambling constellation of Aquarius, supposedly depicting a man pouring water onto the earth. There are a number of deep sky objects in this constellation that are well worth hunting down. M2 is a fine globular cluster 38,000 light years away, and it can be easily seen in binoculars nearby to the third magnitude star Beta Aquarii. This yellow supergiant star is estimated to be 610 light years away. With a magnitude of 6.3, M2 is a difficult naked eye object. It is a good challenge for those with clear dark skies and good eyesight. Small telescopes should be able to resolve individual stars in this cluster. The stars in the cluster have now been dated to approximately 13 billion years old. Some of these are the oldest stars known in our galaxy. To the southwest of Delta Aquarii is NGC 7293, the Helix Nebula. It is the largest and closest planetary nebula at 700 light years away from our solar system. It covers a region of the sky equivalent to half the size of the full moon. In reality, though, it covers a region 2.5 light years in diameter. In small telescopes, you should be able to resolve it as a round circle with a dark center. Larger telescopes reveal more shape, but to see the colors of the nebula, a long exposure photographic image is needed. Another famous planetary nebula is NGC 7009, popularly known as the Saturn Nebula, due to its resemblance to the planet when seen in large telescopes or on photographs. This nebula is close to the star Eta Aquarii. Below Aquarius and northwards towards the bright star Altair, we find a small but distinct constellation called Delphinus, a diamond-shaped group of four stars marking the dolphin's body, and above, for us here in the southern hemisphere, a flattened triangle of three stars forms the dolphin's tail. Gamma Delphinus, marking the dolphin's nose, is a lovely double star consisting of two golden-yellow stars at magnitudes 4.3 and 5.2. Of the 88 constellations in the night sky, Delphinus is 69th in order of size. The nearby constellations of Sagittarius and Aquarius are 86th and 87th respectively. Crux, the Southern Cross, is the smallest of the 88 constellations in size and is lying on its side in our southwestern sky after sunset. Famous throughout the Southern Hemisphere and visible from southern parts of the Northern Hemisphere, this little constellation can be used to find the South Celestial Pole. If you project a line along the length of the cross from the top, Gamma Crucis, to the base, Alpha Crucis, and across the sky, it points towards a bright star called Echina. The halfway point between Crux and Echina is close to the South Celestial Pole. Drop this point to the horizon and you'll be facing south. To marry the cross is Tipanga, the anchor. In Tonga it is Toloa, the duck. An image of the cross has been found at Machu Picchu. In the language of the Inca, the cross is known as Chicana, which means the stair. Near to the cross are the two bright pointer stars, Alpha and Beta Centauri. Alpha, the third brightest star in our night sky, is nearby at only 4.3 light years distance. It consists of a bright pairing of two stars that can be split in small telescopes. With a larger telescope, a much fainter red dwarf can be found not far from Alpha Centauri. Called Proxima, it is the closest known star to our solar system. There is much conjecture as to whether this star is gravitationally bound to the larger and brighter pair of stars. Six single stars, two binary star systems, and a triple star system share a common motion through space with Proxima Centauri and the Alpha Centauri system. It is possible they form a cluster of stars moving through our nearby region of space. If Proxima Centauri is not orbiting around the Alpha Centauri system, then such a moving cluster would help explain their relative closeness. Our closest star, the Sun, has been less active than normal during its current solar cycle. The Sun follows a reasonably regular 11-year cycle of increasing and decreasing number of sunspots and other activity. Over the past 2 years, the number of sunspots has been sporadic, about 50% less than predicted, but recently it seems to show signs of increasing activity. Solar activity is associated with the Sun's magnetic field building up, decreasing and flipping in an 11-year cycle. The current idea is that fast-flowing plasma currents under the Sun's surface are impeding the normal cycle. From the best predictions of solar physicists, this current cycle will peak in 2013, but will be weaker than previous cycles. Will this turn out to be true? Only time will tell. In the evening sky, Saturn is setting in the west not long after sunset. Jupiter will be rising in the east after midnight. The Juno spacecraft launched in August 2011 is due to arrive at Jupiter in 2016. This spacecraft will be placed in a polar orbit and will study the planet's magnetic field and composition. Mars will still be low in our morning sky this month. Now is not the best time for viewing Mars, it is low on our northern horizon. Fortunately, we are no longer dependent on Earth-based observations of Mars. A number of orbiters and rovers have added to our knowledge and continue to send back images and data on the red planet. Late 2011 should see the launch of the Mars Science Laboratory. This large 900 kg rover will land in August 2012 and should spend at least one Martian year exploring a crater called Gale. Mercury and Venus will be poorly placed for viewing during September. We wish all our listeners clear skies from the team here at Carter Observatory.